Welcome to the Rebel at Large Adventure Podcast. I'm Drifter.
And I'm Gypsy.
Talking about ghost towns,
graveyards,
outlaws, heroes,
and ladies of the night.
Howdy, folks. Thanks for joining us for yet another adventure. Today, we wander around a Midwestern cemetery and happen upon some historical figures in the world of beer. First, we're going to touch on a bit of important and impactful history for the United States.
On January 16, 1919, the 18th Amendment of the United States Constitution was ratified. This was a terrible time, folks. Section 1 states,
after 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within, the importation thereof into, or the exportation thereof from the United States and all the territory subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited.
The following year, every state in the United States became a dry state. This act became known as the Volstead Act or the National Prohibition Act.
Sad times in the history of the United States.
Thankfully, it did not last forever.
Right? Well, the Prohibition Act was pushed by the Anti-Saloon League, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, as well as churchers. They felt that if liquor was banned, it would eliminate poverty. There would be a reduction in violent acts. It would create happier families and reduce workplace accidents.
Some states and counties were already restricting the sale and consumption of liquor, but now every state had to abide by the new law. Ironically, by making the sale of liquor illegal, all they did was create more criminals. People were going to drink, and they would do it any way that they could. Speakeasies began popping up all over. They became very creative at making booze and as well as transporting it.
Right.
A lot of songs came from the Prohibition.
Yeah, we had a lot of good music then.
Yep.
Although they did see a decrease in crime the first few years, things began to get worse than they were before. The jails were becoming overcrowded. People were dying from drinking homemade alcohol at an alarming rate. No, the term bathtub gin, don't drink it. And there's also the organized crime that came along with it. Turf wars were started in bigger cities with more folks either going to jail or being killed.
Al Capone.
Yeah, Al Capone times, absolutely. The police could not keep up with it. A lot of folks lost their jobs when the breweries and distilleries were closed down. It takes cities worth of people to run these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And the government lost a lot of money from taxing the sale of booze.
Yep. Well, in 1932, Franklin D. Roosevelt ran for president. He campaigned that he was going to repeal the 18th Amendment. It's a pretty easy one to stand next to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody hates this, so I'm going to get rid of it.
Yeah.
No surprise, he won the election, and he was a man of his word. In December 1933, one representative from each state met in Washington, D.C. to discuss the 21st Amendment. On December 5th, at 3:32, Utah gave the 36th vote needed to repeal the prohibition, and people were able to legally drink once again. Yay!
I know.
I find this kind of funny, actually, because Utah was one of the driest states before the 18th Amendment went into effect because of the amount of Mormons living in the state.
Right.
And yet they were the ones that made it so we could drink again.
Yeah. A hint of compassion with them.
Yeah. And the 18th Amendment is the only amendment that's been repealed.
Is that right?
Yep.
It was a good one to start with. Well, with the anniversary of the repeal of Prohibition just a few days ago, that would have been on December 5th, right?
Yep. December 5th.
Yep. So that was a Monday around here in this side of the country. I don't know what day it was in your side of the country.
It's still Monday.
Okay. Well, we thought it would be fun to talk about some men who played a big role in bringing beer to the United States. While we were in Milwaukee, Wisconsin a few years back, as we do, we spent quite a bit of time wandering around the cemeteries.
Yeah.
We went to the Forest Home Cemetery to visit the Davidson family of Harley Davidson and found some really beautiful headstones out there. We later started to do some research on the folks laid to rest there and found that several of the headstones belonged to men who owned breweries. So crack open a cold one and enjoy a drink with us as we tell you about these folks.
I got it. Cheers.
Cheers.
What are you drinking?
Michelob Ultra Pure Gold.
Wow.
I need my Hugh Hefner pajamas on to drink a pure gold beer.
Yeah, you do. I got
Let me pause. I'll be right back.
You want to do that?
No.
Oh. I got a Topo Chico Ranch water.
Not quite a beer, but...
Well, being a glutard, you only have so many options. Yes.
All right. Well,
okay, let's get into this, guys. Also, by the way, that cemetery, if any of you have a chance to go to it, definitely do. We just kind of went through it pretty quickly, but it was like, look at that one, look at that one, look at that one, over and over. Just big, huge headstones. Really, really cool. So, okay. Valentin Blatz was born on October 1st, 1826 in Germany. His father operated a brewery, and when Valentin was 14, he started working with him. Around the age of 18, he started working with other breweries to get a better understanding on the process of creating beer. Pretty smart. Don't just stick to one person, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 1848, he immigrated to the United States and was living in Buffalo, New York. He worked for about a year in New York at a brewery before he moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. When he arrived in town, he got a job working as a brewmaster for John Braun's Cedar Brewery. During this time, it was common for the employees of a brewery to live with the owner. Kind of cool, but they usually would only have like 5 or 6 employees. So gave them a place to work and live. Pretty smart.
Yeah.
Valentin became friends with John and his wife, and he was a great employee. Within 2 years, he had saved up to $500.
Which is a bit over 15 grand today.
That's not too bad. And then he took that money and decided to venture out on his own and opened a brewery.
Which you can't open a brewery for $15,000 today.
No, you would probably need like $200,000. I don't know what all the machines would cost, but yeah, I don't think you could do it.
Be more than 15 grand.
Yeah.
We probably have 15 grand in the podcast equipment here, so.
Yeah.
Well, sometime in 1851, John Braun was thrown from his horse-drawn beer wagon, killing him. He was murdered by a beer wagon. On December 4th.
Hey, I guess alcohol did kill him.
Yeah, technically. Are you done?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. On December 4th that same year, Valentin married John's widow, Louise Marguerite Schmidt. Blatz then combined the two breweries and created the City Brewery. Production at first was small, with only 500 barrels annually being made. By the 1860s, he became one of the largest breweries in Milwaukee. In 1865, he opened an agency in Chicago to take advantage of the saloons and retailers there, as well as selling to individual consumers.
In 1872, a fire damaged most of his building. Rather than folding up and quitting, he hired August Gunsman to design and build for him a new and larger brewery.
There's a lot of Augusts going on here.
Yeah. Well, he had it built in the Teutonic German Renaissance Revival style. This was very popular back then, as most of the residents in the area were German or German-American. His new building was a state-of-the-art building because it came with its own bottling and packaging system. Pretty cool. No longer outsourcing that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
By 1875, he was up and running and was the first brewer in Milwaukee to ship his beer nationally. The following year, his beer won top prize at the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia. By 1880, he was producing over 100,000 barrels a year and had expanded the brewery to over 3 city blocks. There's old pictures of this online of what his building looked like, and it's huge.
Yeah. Yeah, in Milwaukee, so there's city blocks, you know, it's a big block.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Yeah,
you were joking around earlier. You're definitely going to get your steps in working there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Valentin also invested his money in real estate. What was your response to that? You said they had bicycles.
Yeah, I said they all have bikes.
Anyway, so he's putting his money in real estate. He purchased Pleasant Valley, located by the Milwaukee River, and turned it into Blatz Park, also known as a beer garden. During this time, it was very popular for families to go to beer gardens. Politicians would meet here, and unions were formed in these places. It was common for a beer garden to be located in a wooded area and often by water. Some beer gardens had outdoor venues with live music, restaurants, and even exotic plants and birds. Ostriches? Emus, you think?
Yeah, they probably did.
Exotic?
Peacocks?
Of course, peacocks. What did they say?
I can't do it right now.
By World War I, many of the beer gardens began to fade into history. The Blatz estate continued to own Blatz Park until 1928. The park was sold to the city with plans to construct a riverfront drive, but nothing ever came of it, and eventually everything was taken over by nature.
In 1897, Valentin also invested in the hotel business. He purchased the Central Hotel, made major renovations to the building, and changed the name to the Blatz Hotel. He even had a bar located on the ground floor called Blatz Bar. So for $1.25 to $2 per day, a person could stay at the hotel.
That'd run you about $45 to $72 today.
And if you wanted a room with a bath, it would cost you $2.50 to $3.50 a day.
So about doubling. That goes $90 to $125 if you want a bath.
Yeah, I mean, that seems pretty fair.
Half price for the hostel ones, right?
Yeah. Well, every room had hot water and cold water in it, so pretty state-of-the-art for the time. It was once located on the southwest corner of East Water and Oneida Street, now known as Water and Wells. The building was torn down in 1968. Kind of sad. I hate to see those old buildings go.
Mm-hmm. In 1889, Valentin incorporated his brewery and changed the name to Val Blatz Brewing Company, as in Valentin Blatz. He was producing over 200,000 barrels annually and had a capital stock of $2 million.
Which is just shy of $65 million today.
Shortly after he incorporated, a group of British investors attempted to buy out and merge Blatz with Pabst and Schlitz for $16.5 million.
Yeah, that's a lot. Then, which today would be worth over $540 million.
Half a billion dollars. Well, the offer fell through, and in 1891, Blatz ended up selling out to the U.S. Brewing Company for around $3 million.
Which is just over $98 million.
Well, he did put in the contract a stipulation that allowed him to still have full control over the Milwaukee operations. He just can't walk away.
I was just going to say he couldn't keep his hands out of it.
Yeah, it's like I would have retired.
In 1894, Valentin and his wife took a trip to California to enjoy a more mild winter. His wife was not doing well, and they felt this would help her. After spending 3 months there, they traveled back east. On his way back from the trip, he unexpectedly passed away at the Hotel Ryan in St. Paul, Minnesota. According to the Weekly Wisconsin,
Mr. Blatz was taken ill Saturday morning, but it was not thought that anything very serious was the matter. About 10 o'clock in the evening, he stepped from his room for a moment and on his return sank into a chair and died before medical aid could be procured. Dr. Talbot Jones, who was called, pronounced the cause of death heart disease, complicated by a stomach trouble.
His body was returned to Milwaukee, and his wife had a large and beautiful mausoleum built for him. That one caught my eye instantly. It was amazing.
Yeah, we saw half of these either looking for the Davidsons or from the Davidsons.
Yeah, yep. Plot. Yeah. And we also have pictures of this, so we'll post it on the website for you guys.
Yeah.
He was 68 years old when he passed away. At the time of his death, he was one of Milwaukee's wealthiest men with an estate estimated at $6 million to $8 million.
Which would run you between $208 million to $277 million today.
Yeah, that's nice. His son Albert took over as president of the company after his father passed away. The company did well until Prohibition came into effect. It hurt a lot of people, really.
Mm-hmm.
The United States Brewing sold Blatz to Edward Landsberg in 1920. Landsberg was able to keep the business going when he started selling malt syrup, sodas, and near beer. The business was sold again in 1943 to Schenley Industries. 4 years later, it was named the ninth largest brewery in the United States. Over the next 10 years, sales began to decline, and the brewery was sold again in 1959 to Pabst. The company was then consolidated into their own plant, and the large Blatz Brewing Complex was closed down. In 1986, the building was placed on the National Register. 2 years later, the building became the first industrial building in the city to be transformed into residential apartments. I didn't look up to see how much it would cost to stay there. I should have, though. Mm. And not all of his buildings were still there. Some of them had to be knocked down because they were just too bad.
Right. Not up to code.
Yeah. The Blatt's beer brand still lives on in the portfolio of the Pabst Brewing Company.
Well, the next fellow we want to talk about is Joseph Schlitt. He was born in Rheinhessen, Germany, on May 15, 1831. During his studies, he took a four-year course in bookkeeping. He immigrated to the U.S. and arrived in Milwaukee in 1850.
So now we need to tell you about someone else to help you better understand how Joseph was able to get into the brewing business.
So George August Krug, another August, had immigrated to the United States from Miltenberg, Bavaria, Germany, around 1848. He opened a small restaurant located at 4th and Chestnut Streets in Milwaukee. The following year, 1849, he married Anna Maria Hartig. Anna managed the restaurant, and this gave August time to work on starting a brewery.
I wonder if August and for like a German name would be like how John is for a United States name.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Anybody from Germany want to let us know, would appreciate it. Email in the show notes.
Well, in 1850, George's father came to visit him. He brought with him Krug's 8-year-old nephew, another August, August Uhlein, as well as $800 in gold.
So that would be, the $800 value would be just shy of $31,000 today. However, at that time, gold was valued at about $20 an ounce. It was like $20.67 an ounce. So I just went with 20 bucks an ounce. So based on that, he would have had about 40 ounces of gold. Today, gold spot prices are 1,754 bucks an ounce. Wow. So the gold equivalent as of today would be valued at over 70 grand.
So he probably had more closer to 70,000 today then.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say.
Yeah.
But if we had it in the value of gold versus that much money in cash, is it translates differently.
Okay. Well, the money was used to expand the brewery and hire 4 more employees, with one of them being Joseph Schlitz. George worked hard at expanding his brewery and built the first underground brewer's vault. He tunneled into a hill, and this provided him the cool temperatures needed for brewing and storing. You have to keep it cool, right, when you're brewing beer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, making a lager. Lager means to store.
Okay. August also got to work building large buildings to manufacture his beer. The building was located at 420 Chestnut Street, so pretty close to the restaurant.
Yeah. So to expand on that a little bit, lager means to store, but you're fermenting it at a lower temperature. So that's you're storing it at a lower temperature while it does its fermentation process.
So he probably is making a more lager-styled beer.
Yeah, Budweiser, all those are lagers.
Oh, okay.
Mm, this Michelob Ultra is probably listed as a lager.
Oh, okay. I always thought like lagers were like heavier beers, yeah, like Amberbach. What is that?
This is a light lager.
Okay.
I don't know what an Amberbach is.
Oh,
it's a Bock.
Oh, okay.
It's a Bock beer. All right. Well, by the mid-1850s, August was a large beer distributor, and one of his competitors was Valentin Blatt.
Who we just talked about.
Yeah. His brewery turned from 250 barrels to 1,500 barrels a year. Things, however, went down the tube for August when he fell down a hatchway.
I wasn't laughing that he died. It was funny how you put that.
Several days later, December 30th of 1865, he passed away from his injuries at the age of 41. He was laid to rest in the Forest Home Cemetery. So, from here, let's get back to Joseph now and how he falls into place now that August has passed away.
Some sources say that August knew he was not going to survive his injuries and told his wife to marry Joseph. Or maybe his wife knew that Joseph understood the business and that if she married him, he would help her continue it, which is smart. One thing that is certain is that when August passed away, the 11 lots of real estate he owned was estimated at a value of a little over $20,000.
which would be just over 366 grand today, which I bet you couldn't buy half of one of those lots for 360 grand out there today.
No. There was a total of $15,296 in claims and demands against the estate.
Which is just over 230 grand today.
Which, would that be like the bank loans and things? Is that what that's mean? Okay. And that also included $276 that was owed to Joseph.
Which would be around 5 grand in today's dollars. So 2 years after August passed away in 1858, Joseph and Anna were married. Joseph then invested his own money into the company and had the name of the brewery changed to Joseph Schlitz Brewing Company that same year. The company continued to grow, and by 1867, they were brewing 5,775 barrels a year, making it the fourth largest brewery in Milwaukee, with Blatt's Brewing being the third place.
The Great Chicago Fire, though devastating for many, brought Joseph great success. He donated thousands of barrels of beer to the city when many of their breweries were destroyed by the fire. He used it as an opportunity to build his distribution in Chicago, making his company become known as
the beer that made Milwaukee famous.
Many of the Chicagoans became loyal drinkers to his brand after this. This was the start of him becoming a national distributor. He continued to expand the business and eventually became the largest brewery in the U.S. Good for him.
Yep, good marketing right there. Joseph had been away from home for 26 years now, and in 1875, he decided it was time to make a trip back home. On May 7th, he was on the steamship Schiller as it was entering the English Channel. Unfortunately, the fog was too dense, and at 10 p.m., the ship crashed into Bishop's Rock. The captain was able to back the ship off the rock, but the sea was too rough. This caused the ship to be flung into the rocks 3 more times, causing obviously more damage. Pandemonium ensued on the ship, and all the passengers rushed to the lifeboats. But they quickly found that either the boats were damaged from crashing into the rocks, or they hadn't been maintained and were unsafe to use.
So I was reading some old news articles on this, and one of the articles I read said that he was supposed to come home a day earlier, but he spent an extra day there because he had a late dinner party with friends.
Mm-hmm.
So then he left the next day.
So if he would have taken his original trip, he would have been all right?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, crazy, huh?
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, when the captain fired off his gun, it was thought to be a signal that they had made it safely through the islands. Also, it was dark, and the seas were very rough, and the fog was making it impossible to see anything. No boat was sent to rescue them until the following morning. When they arrived, they found only 5 survivors. In total, 37 people survived the wreck. The death toll for the passengers and the crew was 335.
Which is still 335 dead today.
Yeah, thank you.
And today's dead.
Yes, that's very true. Thanks for translating that for us today.
Of course.
Well, Anna offered a reward of $25,000 for the recovery of Joseph's body, but it was never found.
Yeah, the reward would have been just over 677 grand today.
So 5 years later, in 1880, a sea captain arrived in New York and wrote to the Schlitz family saying that he had the body of Joseph. 5 years later.
It probably stinks a little bit.
The family sent someone to investigate the claims and found them to be untrue.
Huh.
Anna had a cenotaph erected in the Forest Home Cemetery for him. On the base of the monument is a rendering of the ship, the Schiller, at sea. So I found this out while doing research that a cenotaph is a monument for someone who's not actually buried at the location. That was kind of interesting for me to learn that.
Yeah, so what I got you over for your birthday would be a cenotaph because you're not buried underneath that little headstone I had made.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
I would say we could share that, but there's dates on there that we'd have to kind of cross out.
I could probably mount it above the bed. So when you're sleeping, you would technically be resting under it.
You're on to something.
All right. It's getting ridiculous. Well, Anna did receive 50 grand from Joseph's life insurance policy and used that money to help keep the brewery going.
Which is just over 1.3 million.
In today's money.
Yep.
Joseph and Anna did not have any children together, so she turned to her nephews from August Crook's side of the family for help. Remember when we told you about 8-year-old August Uhlein coming to the U.S.?
Yep.
Well, he stayed, and as he got older, he started working with Joseph and learned how to manage the company. Conveniently enough, they had a backup plan.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was kind of cool, too, that Joseph took over that family's business, right, when mm-hmm. August passed away, but yet they still stayed connected with that side of the family.
Right.
Because it would have been really easy for them, both Joseph and Anna, to be like, okay, bye, we don't need you guys anymore.
Oh, yeah.
And yet they still maintained that relationship, so I thought that was pretty cool.
Absolutely. Well, now 33-year-old August was put in charge. I mean, payroll had to be super easy on this because you don't have to even change names when one guy dies. You just change the last name. Right? Everybody's named August.
Yeah.
Well, he, along with his two brothers, Henry and Edward, were able to not only keep the business going, but they were able to turn it into a huge success. It was considered at this time to change the name. However, the Schlitz brand was just well too recognized at this time, so
yeah.
It would have been a folly to do so.
Yeah, I read also that in his will, he had put that he didn't want the name to change either.
Oh.
But I only saw that in one source, so it was kind of like, I don't know if that's true or not.
No.
In 1877, they were the 10th largest U.S. brewer, and by 1895, they were the third largest. So that's a good jump for these guys.
Yeah, not even 20 years.
Yeah. When Prohibition came into effect, the company changed the name to Joseph Schlitz Beverage Company, not Brewing Company. They then began producing near beer, soft drinks, malt syrup, and even chocolate candies. Interesting. And they called them Eline. And they said that the chocolate candies never took off because Hershey's was so popular at that time.
So nobody wants the Elines.
No. Once the repeal of Prohibition happened, the company went back to brewing beer and growing its production. Over the next 40 years, they stayed near the top of being the largest beer producer. The company began to decline when they started making changes to the recipe. They were trying to make it cheaper, right?
Of course.
So customers felt the beer flavor was gone and that it went too flat too fast. The company also did not make any light beers like its competitors were starting to make and like you are enjoying right now.
Yes. Yeah, they didn't. Nobody cared about skinny beer.
Yeah, but by the 80s is when, you know, all those guys were starting to do them, even though they weren't really taking off. They just weren't evolving.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you got to keep up with the times. Well, in 1982, Schlitz was eventually sold to the Stroh Brewing Company of Detroit, Michigan. The status of the Schlitz name declined to the point it was considered cheap beer. In 1999, cheap beer kings, Pabst, purchased the Schlitz brand.
I thought that same thing. I was like, well, Pabst is kind of a cheap beer, so yeah. I guess it would make sense they would purchase them.
Yeah. Well, the formula for the original beer was lost during the 1970s, but research has since been done and the former Schlitz is now being produced, which is funny because, like, what was the company Toyota bought? Scion? Something like that?
Yeah.
So they bought the competitor to put them out of business.
Yeah.
Further promote the sales of what they have, which would have been considered obviously a comparable car if it was hurting their sales, right?
Well,
so the same thing if you have a cheap beer buying out another cheap beer brand, funny to make two cheap beer brand names instead of just buying out your competition.
Yeah, but also with aspects of this, Schlitz was still a very well-known name.
Right.
And so maybe Pabst knew, hey, we know what's wrong with this beer and we want to fix it to try and put it back up on top again. But yet we own it now.
Right.
Because there's a lot to be said in a name. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the new beer, along with new advertisements, was released in 2008. In 2009, a former 1968 Playboy Playmate, Cynthia Myers, became the spokesperson for Schlitz.
Today, you can still buy Schlitz. I don't know if it's at the grocery store.
It's a regional thing, though. You're going to find it all over the Midwest, but we don't sell it here in Utah.
Yeah, because when I tried to get on their website, it said to type in the area code, and it would tell you if anything was close to you, and it didn't pull anything up.
Hmm.
So I think that it's actually pretty awesome that perhaps one of its rivals during its heyday, was able to save the company and also bring back its original recipe. So good on you guys, Pabst.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we also found inside the Forest Home Cemetery, Frederick Pabst. We keep talking about him, and he's laid to rest there. His headstone is extremely large and features a woman on the steps looking as though she's about to start to cry. We're not going to get into the history of Pabst at this time, as we don't want to turn this into too long of an episode. And I actually kind of think he could probably be his own episode. So thanks, guys, for spending time with us and celebrating the repeal of Prohibition and learning about two of Milwaukee's major brewers. And to that, I say cheers.
I bet I have a Milwaukee beer somewhere in this house.
Yeah.
It's got to be a PBR laying around. All right.
PBR did fun things for a while there with their cans and putting like the fun designs on them and stuff. I remember that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that wraps up our Milwaukee visit for the moment, at least.
Yeah. We'll be back.
Yeah. We keep going back to all these places. So did you get all the dad jokes out of your system? Or?
No.
You've got...
Not even kind of. I have a good one. I say that all the time, but this one, actually, I was laughing about it, okay?
Oh.
And I didn't find it in the book you gave me because I couldn't... This book you gave me seems like more family-friendly dad jokes, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, well, since we've been talking about beer, let's do an alcohol dad joke, okay?
No. Okay.
So an elderly man was stopped by the police around 2 a.m. and was asked by the officer where he was going at this time of night. The man replies, "I'm on my way to a lecture about alcohol abuse and the effects it has on the human body, as well as smoking and staying out late." The officer then asks, "Really? Who's giving that lecture at this time of night?" The man replies, "That would be my wife." Yeah. That's good.
Huh? That one's actually a funny one.
I got a chuckle out of you. It was a real chuckle, too.
Wow. How true for so many
folks. I got another real laugh out of you, too, when I told you my turkey joke the other day. Oh. You did real. You like sat there for a minute, and then you actually laughed.
What was? Do you want to share your turkey joke? We just had Thanksgiving when this comes out.
So yeah.
Tell me your.
So I was at the store the other day, and a woman was sifting through all the turkeys, trying to find the right one. And she asked the store clerk, "Do these get any larger?" And the guy looked at her and said, "No, they're dead."
Right. They're not going to grow anymore. I remember now. Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was funny. I think they're all funny.
Well, there you have it, folks. We appreciate y'all so much for 100%. Joining us again and supporting the Rebel at Large Adventure Podcast. If you want to stay up to date with us, as always, we're most active on the Instagram.
At Rebel at Large.
We post some photos of our adventures on our website.
RebelAtLarge.com, where you'll find links to our new merch store, Patreon, if you want to help fuel our tanks and get some awesome shirts. Our email's there if you want to get in touch with us, as well as links to our other social deals.
We'll talk to y'all here in a couple of weeks.
Safe travels.
We'll see y'all down the road.
He campaigned.
He what?
He companioned. That's what I was going to say.
Was he going to win on his companion? His companionship run?
With an estate estimated at $6 million to $800,000.
Joseph had been away from home for 26 years, and in 1875, he decided to make a trip back home. I think I said trick.
I think you did too. I was like, that's tricky.
Yeah. The beer that made Milwaukee famous.